Lecture 11, Mata Hari and Company in World War I.
Strange things happen on the battlefield. In the opening stages of the First World War, in the August days of 1914, German radio operators who were stationed in the eastern provinces of Germany started picking up signals. These were the signals of orders being passed back and forth from the advancing Russian armies bearing down on them. This must have been a horrifying moment for the radio operators, because they knew that the German forces in the east were badly outnumbered by the oncoming Russians. Most German forces had been directed against France to strike a knockout blow in the west. And then, on listening closely, the German radio operators were astonished that the transmissions were not being sent in code. They were being sent in the clear, as the expression went, without any encipherment. The radio operators did not know what to think. Could this be true? Was it real? Or was this a trap meant to misdirect German military preparations? If you were a German military commander, what would you do? Which way would you be inclined to believe? How the Germans decided and what they did, and what the outcome was, we'll see shortly. The First World War broke out in 1914 and would last for four blood-soaked years until November 11, 1918. The war ended with the defeat of Germany and the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian, Russian, and Turkish empires. And even after the end of the war, aftershocks would continue, especially as the world grappled with the challenge of the radical regime of communism established by the Bolsheviks in the Soviet Union and their worldwide revolutionary ambitions. In this sense, World War I has been a key watershed of modern times, and the war confronted contemporaries with a constant barrage of surprises, shocks, and frustrations to what they had expected would happen next. The war had begun with expectations of quick victory, glorious cavalry charges, splendid battlefield triumphs, and, as the expression went, the boys back home before Christmas. Instead, by the fall of 1914, the armies had ground to a halt. Fighting bogged down into trench warfare, a static situation, with waves of doomed attacks across no man's land that separated the opposing trenches. And even the sacrifice of thousands of young men was only capable of shifting the front line by miles, or maybe even only yards. All sides in the First World War now cast about for ways of breaking the deadlock, of finding some alternative way in which victory might be won. This was the task of diplomats, who sought to bring in new allies to their own side. It was a task also of scientists who tried to invent new, fearsome weapons like poison gas, submarines, military airplanes, in the hope that this might be the decisive new tool for the battlefield. And it was also especially the task of spy masters. Think all the way back to the start of our course when we mentioned the Chinese philosopher of war Sun Tzu, who suggested that espionage was extremely cost-effective and might be a good way of achieving decisive victory at much less cost than regular engagements. That was a phenomenon at work here, the allure of spying as a way of tipping the war. In this lecture, we'll explore the new possibilities that the war opened up for women spies, whose role could be tragic, as in the case of Mata Hari, or strategically vital, and for codebreakers working on signals intelligence, or SIGINT. In the case of women spies, we need really to start with the most famous woman spy of all time, Mata Hari. She's the very archetype of the femme fatale, the deadly female, seductive and dangerous, luring men and perhaps entire nations to their destruction. Mata Hari seems to personify the link between the secret world of espionage and sex. That's the myth of Mata Hari, and it's precisely the way in which her history is covered in myth that makes her real tragic story doubly compelling and interesting for us, because it allows us to follow how the myth of the female spy was constructed and repeated to the point where her name, is one that still conjures up powerful images in our own time a century later. Mata Hari, to put it lightly, was not what she seemed. The images that we have of her, repeated in photographs, in films, and even in a ballet written about Mata Hari, are familiar. A nearly naked, writhing, bejeweled, foreign, exotic dancer who conjures up Oriental mystery. But in fact, these images are a deliberate self-creation of a remarkable woman who willed for herself a new identity to replace the one that she had suffered under before. The woman who became Mata Hari was born with a decidedly unexotic name of Margaretha Gertrude Zelle in 1876 in the Netherlands, in the town of Leeuwarden. Hoping to escape the humdrum everyday life of her hometown, in 1895, Margaretha married a much older man, a colonel in the Dutch colonial army named Rudolf MacLeod. Now, I know MacLeod doesn't sound very Dutch. He was a Dutch officer of Scottish ancestry originally. The pair left for an overseas posting in the Dutch East Indies, out in the colonies. Their family life was not a happy one, in spite of bringing two children into the world. MacLeod was jealous, alcoholic, temperamental, and abused his wife. Tragedy struck them when their son died, and Margaretha and her husband separated and divorced soon after their return to Europe. At this point, Margaretha launched a new life and a new identity for herself. She moved to Paris in 1904, the glorious city of light. And she took a new name for herself, Mata Hari, Malaysian for the words Eye of the Dawn. She perfected an act which one might call anthropological striptease. She would dance for audiences, removing veils one at a time, and afterwards would sit down and tell them stories of the Orient, stories of her supposed past as a temple dancer in the Far East. Aside from the stage, Mata Hari also became a much sought-after courtesan, involved in serial affairs in exchange for financial support and gifts with important men in the world of government, diplomacy, and business. But by the time the First World War broke out, Mata Hari was nearing 40, and her popularity, once great, had begun to fade. It was at this point that Mata Hari entered into the world of espionage as a way of bolstering flagging fortunes. We've actually seen this phenomenon before of the need for financial support pressing people towards espionage in the case of the Italian lover and secret agent Casanova in an earlier lecture. In this shadowy world, Mata Hari offered her assistance to both the French and the German intelligence services. To this very day, the question of what she actually did is shrouded in mystery. It still remains not entirely clear what, if any, important information she might have collected and passed in her brief career of espionage. Later, when she was arrested by the French authorities, she admitted that she had had a German connection, and indeed the German intelligence services knew her as spy H21, but she also insisted that she had never actually made good on her promises, that she had always not passed to the Germans any crucial information. At the same time, for a period funded by the French intelligence services, she had traveled to neutral countries, to Spain and the Netherlands, exploiting her social connections and gathering intelligence, so it seems. Her end, however, came when a German military attaché of her acquaintance sent telegrams back to Berlin which mentioned her. The telegrams were sent in a code that had already been broken by French counterintelligence. She was suspect. The French authorities arrested Mata Hari in February of 1917, and they held a closed trial in July of 1917. In this trial, the prosecution may have used forged evidence against her. There are shades of the Dreyfus scandal and the use of forged evidence against Dreyfus here as well. In the trial, the prosecution claimed that Mata Hari herself was responsible for the death of 50,000 French soldiers. But they never actually explained how this was supposed to have happened. That remained secret. On October 15, 1917, Mata Hari was executed by a French firing squad. It was suspected by more cynical observers that Mata Hari had actually been an inconsequential figure, but a convenient scapegoat for the larger problems in the French war effort in 1917. In that year, 1917, significant numbers of units in the exhausted French frontline forces in the trenches had mutinied, and the trial of a notorious spy offered a welcome distraction from the more serious challenges of the day. The legend that grew up around Mata Hari has endured ever since. And it's indicative of some of her legend that accounts vary and rumors swirl about her last moments on this earth. Some accounts claim that she blew a kiss to the firing squad. Other more sober accounts simply recount her calmness in facing death. Now, just to note what should be obvious from this account as well, one needs to be clear that women accused of being spies in the First World War, as we saw in the case of Mata Hari, could be executed. And you'll note that this was a significant shift from the days of the American Civil War, when women spies had been spared. Clearly, social conventions and social values were shifting. And this was, in a sense, a brutal kind of tribute to the role of women, because society saw their spying as potentially so effective that it might be decisive and thus needed to be discouraged by the use of the death sentence. Other women spies in the First World War had careers that both resembled and in significant ways differed from that of Mata Hari. One example was a French spy by the name of Marthe Richer, who was born in Lorraine in 1889. She was clearly a remarkable woman. Even before the war, she had been a female airplane pilot, and thus she had acquired the nickname L'Alouette, the Lark. After her husband was killed, serving in the French army in the war, she moved to Madrid, and there she spied on German spies in neutral Spain. She went so far as to become the mistress of the German naval attaché in the German embassy, and apparently at that point met Mata Hari. How fascinating it would have been to listen in to a conversation between these remarkable women. Alouette is credited with passing crucial information on German submarine refueling points along the Spanish coast and the routes that were secretly taken from Spain into France across the Pyrenees Mountains by German agents. Another woman spy is remarkable for the way in which her case, in a really bizarre way, shows a radical disjuncture between the real person we know about and all of the legends that were developed around her. This woman was Dr. Elisabeth Schregmüller. The very title I mentioned before her name, Doctor, is already testimony to her remarkable character and drive, because at this point, doctorates for women were still very rare. But Schregmüller had earned her doctorate in philosophy in 1913 at the University of Freiburg in Germany's Black Forest region. When the war broke out, Schregmüller longed to be of service to her fatherland as a patriotic duty. And so she pestered the head of German military intelligence, Walter Nicolai, so mercilessly that he finally did give her a job. She was posted to the male censorship office in German-occupied Belgium, and she spent her time there examining the postal traffic for any signs of suspicious activity. And she apparently was very good at this task because her potential was recognized as being far larger. She was sent back to Germany for further training in clandestine work in Baden-Baden, a resort, and then was sent back to the West, to northern Belgium, to a new spy school that had been established in Antwerp to train spies for the German cause. Now, what follows is a little bit ludicrous and is probably the predictable result of letting academics and especially professors loose on the secret world and its intrigues. In her instruction of agents as a teacher of espionage, Schregmüller aimed to systematize the job of spying. This has been described as an entirely academic point of view, uninspired, unpractical, humorless, methodical. Schregmüller created endless drills and exercises for her students that were supposed to make deception rational, orderly, and almost a science. She emphasized training, training, and more training. This was kind of an apotheosis of professionalization gone wrong. In the process, Schregmüller seemed to miss entirely the way in which espionage work and good tradecraft demands not just method and drill, but other spontaneous qualities that are hard to teach, like a skill for improvisation, natural sneakiness, and inborn subtlety. In a way, it's not really surprising that a number of the spies she trained were big failures. Let me give one example. Two Dutchmen whom she had trained were sent to infiltrate Britain, to Portsmouth, with its naval installations. The two Dutchmen were to observe the British fleet there and to report back. They were to report back to Germany by using, in their correspondence, cigar varieties as a code. Let me give you an example. So 3,000 Corona cigars would mean three battleships, while a certain number of Havana cigars would mean perhaps torpedo boats. So it was supposed to look like mercantile correspondence masking the reality of military spying. Now, in short order, when their commercial correspondence was inspected by British postal censors, it set off alarm bells for them because they noticed somebody in Portsmouth had ordered 48,000 cigars in 1 week, and that stretched the bounds of what one could believe. This was a failure of tradecraft of the first order. But what happened afterwards is also fascinating. After the war, another aspect of Schwegmüller's record. After the war, Schwegmüller, quite without any action on her part, became a focus of legends on the Allied side. Schwegmüller herself simply returned to Germany and became a professor of history at the University of Munich and eventually died in 1940. But at the same time, after the war, the sensational press in the Allied countries started relating stories of a mysterious woman spy in Belgium working for the Germans. This spy was variously known as the Doctor or the Beautiful Blonde of Antwerp. And the nicknames just got more outrageous from there. She was also known as Tiger Eyes Schwegmüller or the Black Cat, the Red Tiger, the Baroness, the Lady with the Cigarette. These legends credited Schwegmüller with unusual powers over men. It was said that she could dominate them psychologically and with her allure. It was claimed that Schwegmüller was as irresistibly beautiful as she was sadistic and ready to kill. Now, in fact, if you look at photographs from the period and you see a picture of Schwegmüller, she looks quite different. Sober, serious, composed, nothing like the fantastic image that developed around her afterwards. A different and apparently far more effective covert operative that we want to consider next was the British nurse Edith Cavell. Now, I need to point out, Cavell was not so much a spy as the leader of an underground railroad to help escaping Allied prisoners in occupied Belgium. In this way, Cavell resembled Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad before the American Civil War, which saved slaves, channeling them northwards. Cavell also paid for her heroic activities with her life. She was executed by the Germans early in the war in 1915. Cavell had been born into a middle-class family in England, and she'd been trained for a career as a nurse. And she was apparently very good at nursing because she became an instructor in turn. In 1907, so far before the war begins, Cavell had been invited to run a new school for nurses in Brussels, in Belgium. When the war did break out in 1914, Cavell didn't evacuate. She stayed at her post. At this point, at the age of 48, and already a respected professional, Cavell assumed a new role. Or perhaps the new role found her, because it seems to have hinged on a moment of decision that took only an instant. In November of 1914, she was asked to help hide two British soldiers who had gotten lost and now were behind German enemy lines. Cavell decided to help. And for the next 4 months, she got more and more involved in the business of helping people escape from occupied Belgium into neutral Holland. With over 30 other comrades helping her, including many women, among them one princess and one countess, Cavell ran an entire network that functioned so efficiently that some 200 Allied soldiers were eventually smuggled out by it. When some members were caught by the Germans, however, the network was exposed and the members were arrested, Cavell among them. They were put on trial, and a third of those who were on trial were women, in October of 1915. And then, after being convicted, in the early morning of October 12, 1915, Cavell was executed. Whereas some other agents who'd been put on trial had received commuted death sentences, Cavell was shot in part because it seems the German occupation authorities wanted to make an example of her specifically, hoping in this way to pacify the entire occupied region by showing exemplary brutality. As you might expect, this intention backfired tremendously because the international outcry against the execution of a nurse was great. And the outrage in the United States, especially, at this point still neutral in the war, was especially damaging to the German war effort. Next, we should move to examine a phenomenon that really marked a profound shift in how espionage was done. And that was the huge increase in the importance of what earlier had not been as sophisticated a branch of intelligence, the increase in the importance of SIGINT, or signals intelligence. That's to say, the interception of enemy communications, as distinct from HUMINT, or human intelligence of individual agents. Returning to the scene with which we started the lecture, recall that on the Eastern Front, Russian armies at the start of the war were bearing down on Berlin. The German defenders of the easternmost province of East Prussia were outnumbered, and their only hope would be to fight a running battle against the invaders as the Russian armies moved between the small lakes of the region so that the Germans might be able, perhaps, to concentrate on parts of the Russian force, defeating different segments of the army in turn. And it was at this point that German radio operators were amazed to hear Russian army orders given without code. In fact, what was happening was this. The Russians had deliberately decided not to encode the messages, not out of stupidity or incompetence. This was actually a calculated decision. They thought they were running a calculated risk because they felt that the clarity of using uncoded orders was better than the confusion that might follow from garbled encoded messages that were decoded wrong. The mistakes that could be introduced in coding might further impede the Russian advance. So it was a deliberate choice. But these intercepts allowed the German forces to beat back two Russian armies separately and to score the only major large battlefield victory of the war at Tannenberg. By contrast, things were not going as well for the Germans in the West. When the war broke out, the recently reorganized British intelligence service went into action. They'd actually been carefully tracking the German spies in Britain, all 24 of them, right up to the start of the war. And within hours of war being declared, polite British policemen came to the front doors of those 24 spies, knocked on the door, and politely asked whether the German spies would please come along, and they would spend the rest of the war in confinement. So as a result, the Germans lacked human intelligence about the British expeditionary force that was sent to the continent, which helped foil the German attack plan against France. But the German Kaiser was enraged when he found out about the arrest of the German spies in Britain. He shouted, demanding to know why no one had told him that there were no German spies still at large. But something else was happening at the same time that was ultimately even more important. British ships, right at the outset of the war, located the German underwater telegraph cables that ran along the ocean floor of the English Channel and lifted them up. And then the British ships cut those cables, not just once, but twice. And the reason for that was so that some foolhardy German repair ship couldn't get to those cables and repair them. It was meant to make repair impossible. The result of this simple action, was that the German communications across the Atlantic and to many other parts of the world were now cut off. And Germany would always be at a disadvantage in trying to affect world opinion freely as a result. As the war set in, the British intelligence service went about the task of breaking German codes. A crucial role was played here by the Royal Navy Director of Intelligence, Captain Reginald Blinker Hall, whom we'd already met in an earlier lecture as a dashing naval attaché. Blinker, incidentally, was not his given name. It was his nickname because of a nervous tic in one of his eyelids. But neither the nickname nor the nervous disorder stopped him from being tremendously effective. Blinker Hall ran a special office, the decoding center called Room 40, of the old Admiralty Building in London. The key breakthrough in the work of Room 40 came when they were able to get the German Navy code by a stroke of luck. On August 26, 1914, the German warship Magdeburg, which had been sailing in the Baltic Sea, ran aground on the island of Odensholm off of Estonia. Now, in spite of a German rescue ship showing up pretty quickly to help, the Russians were able to capture the ship first and to get the code book that the ship was carrying. The Russians passed this code book to their British allies. This was a tremendous help. And then two other breakthroughs came with other dramatic and quite coincidental events. First, a fishing boat in the North Sea found in its nets a chest that had been sunk by a German ship as it went down. That chest contained consular codes, and this meant that the Allies would be able to read German diplomatic traffic. Then Room 40 also got the Merchant Marine Code of the German Merchant Navy when, on the other side of the world, Australian naval forces stopped the German steamer and found the code aboard there before the Germans could sink it overboard. There's an instructive and humbling lesson here that has to do with tradecraft. All of these coups were not the result of human intelligence or long-term plotting. They all involved chance. But the lesson for tradecraft is that knowing how to exploit chance to the fullest turns out to be absolutely key. Another sobering lesson about tradecraft involved whether the intelligence Room 40 got was even used. It was at first difficult for Blinker Hall to get other parts of the British war effort to take the intelligence product of Room 40 seriously. It took some time before it was trusted as reliable, and this may have had fateful results. In advance of the one great naval showdown of the war, the Battle of Jutland between the German and British navies, which was essentially a draw, indecisive in its result. In advance of that battle, Hall's decoders had news of the fact that the German navy was moving out a week before the battle. But this, as well as later crucial information about the location of the German navy, didn't reach Admiral Jellicoe, the commander of the British fleet at the time, in sufficient time to make a difference. Blinker Hall's office was also active not only in deciphering and evaluating enemy information, but also in the complicated and dark art of disinformation, the deliberate passing of incorrect information to misdirect the enemy. In the fall of 1916, for instance, in a classic case, Blinker Hall spread disinformation that claimed that the British were going to be landing in northern Belgium to outflank the Germans behind their trenches. This is how Hall did it. He used a secret code for a message. This secret code he had actually planted with German intelligence earlier, so he knew that the Germans would be able to read this secret code. He sent a message to Rotterdam in the neutral Netherlands with an agent who he already knew was known to the Germans as a British agent. In Rotterdam, the agent left his suitcase in his hotel and went out for a meal. When he came back, he'd noticed, because of changes in the position of the suitcase, that the suitcase had been opened. So now Blinker Hall knew that the news had been passed to the Germans. And in addition, just as icing on the cake, as it were, Hall also had fake copies of a British newspaper printed up and passed to the Germans in an exclusive edition, which was intended just for the German intelligence services as a readership, which gave news suggesting preparations for the landing that he had presented as a misdirection. But there's a postscript to this story that suggests that disinformation also has its dangers. Ironically, as German troops started massing on the Belgian coast to meet this alleged invasion, the British military noticed the buildup, and they feared that this was the beginning of a prepared German invasion, and so they rushed great numbers of British troops there as well. They had not been told of Blinker Hall's misinformation. How embarrassing it must have been for Blinker Hall to finally have to break it to his comrades that he was responsible for this misunderstanding. And this is an important point for tradecraft. There's certainly the danger of getting trapped in your own disinformation and intrigues. A further potential trap could lie in plans that seemed very attractive. plans to covertly undermine the enemy's morale and cohesion on the home front. What could go wrong? A spectacular example of how such an act of subversion changed the entire world history of the 20th century, we'll examine in our next lecture.